I'd like now to welcome Harshini Mukundan. She is principal, investigator, and team leader in chemistry for biomedical applications at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, the return of tuberculosis?
Yes. I mean, most people think of tuberculosis as a very old disease that consumed people. It was actually called consumption thousands of years ago, hundreds of years ago. But of late, with the increase in HIV, AIDS, which compromises your immune system, as well as increase in drug resistance, the disease has actually come back with a bang, so much so that the World Health Organization categorized it as a re-emerging disease in 2006.
Where are you seeing it, and in what populations?
Well, there are some areas of the world where the incidence is much higher than the others, that's for sure. Parts of Southeast Asia, parts of Africa, parts of South America, Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union, these are hotspots for the disease. But you are seeing cases throughout the world. So every single country in the world has reported it.
Including the U.S.?
Including the United States, yes.
Are there any particular groups within all those areas that are especially vulnerable?
Yeah, immunocompromised individuals are vulnerable. That could be very old people. It could be individuals with HIV or AIDS or autoimmune diseases. The reason for that is that tuberculosis is a very slow-growing bug, and usually if your immune system is alive and well, it can keep it under control. So you may be exposed, but you won't actually get sick with it. But once that immune system goes down, for whatever reasons, you can actually develop active infection.
Now, didn't we all get tuberculosis vaccines as children?
Some people did. They don't vaccinate children with the BCG in most parts of the world right now. In some countries, they do. Some countries in Africa and India, they still vaccinate kids at birth. But the vaccine is only so effective. The efficiency rate reported can vary anywhere between 10 to 25%. The immunity also wanes with age, so you really don't retain the immunity very well as an adult. So it's not very good at preventing disease.
When you see tuberculosis, is it obvious when people have it, or is it hard to diagnose?
It's hard to diagnose. It looks like a lot of respiratory infections if it presents in the pulmonary system, which is, you know, like the flu or pneumonia or something like that. But the symptoms are still much more apparent than when it presents elsewhere in the body. So you can actually have tuberculosis in the lymphatic system, in your blood, in the brain, meningitis, and those are even harder to diagnose. The tests for tuberculosis are not very good, and they fail in certain combinations and in certain presentations of the disease. So it's actually a huge diagnostic challenge, especially because if you misdiagnose it, the treatment with regular broad-spectrum antibiotics don't work very well for TB. So it's important to get it right and to diagnose it with the right, to treat it with the right drugs.
And we'll get into that in a moment, but what is the proper treatment for tuberculosis once it's diagnosed?
So once it's diagnosed, they give combination chemotherapy with two different drugs. The first line of drugs are isoniazid and rifampin, but the treatment lasts for 6 months. Because it's a slow-growing organism and it takes a long time to get rid of it from the body. The first line of drugs, many tuberculosis cases are showing resistance to them, so there are second line of drugs that have to be brought in if the individual has drug-resistant TB, which is a huge concern. And that's actually one of the main reasons why TB is a bigger problem today than we would have expected it to be, is the resistance to treatment.
Now, tell us about the work that you're doing with respect to tuberculosis.
So our group is focused on trying to develop diagnostics that work really well in people. And we try to do this by mimicking the immune recognition. The bottom line is every time you see a bug, a pathogen, your immune system knows that it's something bad. It doesn't matter if it's natural or not. It doesn't matter if it's a virus or a bacterium. Whether you've seen it before or not, you can immediately see that it's something bad and you can mount an immune recognition to it. Now, if we could only mimic that in the laboratory, maybe we'd have a universal strategy for diagnostics, and that's been the focus of research in our lab. So we've tried to do that for TB, and we try to pick up bits and pieces of the bug that are floating around in the body of people that are sick with the disease at that given time point. using new methods and assays that have been developed by our team.
So do we know? I mean, the body has these wonderful ways of recognizing what is an intruder, what is a pathogen, what is not. But do you know how that works? I mean, is it something that we can mimic?
Yes. Scientists have been looking into it, and we have some idea. It's not a complete picture yet, but there's been a lot of work done on it recently. Every time you get infected by a bacterium or a virus, if the organism is growing in the body, you know, as when you're sick, it scruffs off bits and pieces of itself in the body, and these are virulence factors. They're what is required for you to become sick or, you know, by that bug. These are the signatures that our immune receptors recognize. And there are these receptors, toll-like receptors for one, which are actually sitting there collecting toll, if you will, which bind to these signatures because they see a pattern on them that they recognize, and they immediately results in a transduction of signals and results in mounting an immune response to it. So what we are looking for is those bits and pieces that are scruffed off by the bug, and we want to be the receptors that see them.
Now those, I mean, there's so many friendly bacteria in the body. How do these immune receptors know the difference between the virulent ones, the pathogenic ones, and the ones that we need or are friendly?
Because only the pathogenic ones produce these virulence factors that invade you. For example, lipopolysaccharide that's produced by E. coli or Salmonella that can cause, the tummy bug, quite honestly. It's an endotoxin. It's what causes people to go into endotoxic shock sometimes when they have the severe stomach flu, and that's one of these signatures.
And those kinds of responses, like the like having the stomach flu, going into shock, throwing up, all those things, are responses that ultimately keep us healthy by trying to expel those?
It's a balance. So the same molecules that cause the endotoxic shock and make you really sick are also recognized by our immune system, which says, let's try to get rid of this bug right now so we don't go into endotoxic shock. So your immune system does its best to try to ward off the invaders. In some cases it succeeds, in some cases it does not, and then you have to go to the doctor to get some additional help.
The methods that you're using, we're talking about tuberculosis, but presumably they're also useful for other diseases?
Yeah, so we work on several diseases. So this one project that we're working on with children in Kenya, in collaboration with the University of New Mexico Health Sciences Center, Dr. DJ Perkins's group, is looking at malaria, HIV, bacteremia associated with Salmonella, staph infections, streptococcal infections, and tuberculosis in the same population. So these strategies, because they're immune-based strategies, can be broadly applied to a lot of different bugs, and that's what we're trying to do.
The kinds of immune responses that you're talking about have evolved in human beings over millions of years. Do we have similar responses in animals? Are there analogs in other creatures, other mammals?
Yes and no, but when a bug infects a human or an animal, it always scruffs off these virulence factors. So if that's what you're measuring, then the strategies that you develop can be applied to animals as well. In the case of tuberculosis, the mycobacteria infect a whole range of species, from camels to cheetahs, quite honestly. And one of the major problems is another kind of mycobacterium, Mycobacterium bovis, that actually affects cattle. And it causes bovine tuberculosis. A lot of wildlife carry it, like deer and elk, badgers in the UK.
And they don't get it, but they carry it.
Well, they can get sick from it too, but they can carry it and not be sick from it as well. And they can transfer the bug to cows. And so when you consume meat that's not fully processed or rare, or dairy products that are not pasteurized, you can get the bug. So it can be transmitted to humans. So we've actually applied our diagnostic methods to cattle as well. We've worked with the New Mexico Livestock Board and ranchers and veterinarians with the state, with New Mexico small business programs, and we've tried to adapt our assays in collaboration with the USDA. And we've actually demonstrated that we can use our method for diagnosing bovine tuberculosis quite effectively in these animals.
Now, are these same tests used with human beings?
the same kind of test. The strategy is exactly the same. The reagents might be slightly different depending upon how you want to apply it.
Where are they being used?
So right now it's all in development. So we did a clinical, I don't know if you call it a clinical trial with animals, but we did evaluation in animals in collaboration with the USDA. We got samples from them and tested our methods. And now we are trying to see how we can actually take it to market for broader use in the case of the animal diagnostics. In the case of the humans, we did our first clinical cohort in South Korea in collaboration with the NIH, the tuberculosis research section. It was a blinded study, so they collect samples and then they blind them twice and send them, and then we take a look at them to see if we can pull out these signatures. And we were very successful, and now we are actually doing a second cohort in Uganda in collaboration with Johns Hopkins and the Clinical Diagnostics Research Consortium. We're also starting to collect samples in Kenya for a pediatric tuberculosis trial because pediatric tuberculosis is very hard to diagnose. Kids less than 2 years don't know how to cough out sputum, which is what is usually used for diagnosing the disease.
Yeah.
And so there's actually not any reliable diagnostic for pediatric tuberculosis, so it's a huge challenge. So we're trying to look at that. We're doing a lot of this in collaboration with foundations like the Foundation for Innovative Diagnostics and agencies like that. So we'll have a path forward for taking these assays to people that really need them. And so that's what we're working on right now.
What is your greatest hope for this work?
I hope it leads to a very efficient way to diagnose active tuberculosis infection in people and in animals. Elephants get TB, for example, from mahouts, Indian, and circus handlers.
Oh my goodness!
So they get human tuberculosis, so I'm hoping that it results in a good way to diagnose the infection, so that we can actually prevent spreading it to other people. You can initiate timely treatment. You can track treatment efficiency over the course of time. I want it to be used in Africa, in parts of the world where they're really needed. You know, when people are in other countries or coming in or whatever, in a cost-effective manner. If the assay costs $100 a pop, it's really not going to be usable in large numbers in rural Africa, for instance. So
right.
That's what we're working towards.
Harshini Mukundan is principal investigator and team leader in chemistry for biomedical applications at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.